yesterday Ann and I went on a hike up to Honeymoon Heights, and we took with us an orange. Now, had I been back in South Carolina and just gone up into the Smokies, after we peeled the orange, I would simply have probably thrown the orange peelings under a pile of leaves. But knowing Holden's expectations about leaving no trace, I simply put the peelings in my pocket and walked back. Now, if I did that enough, pretty soon that would become internalized, and it would be something that I wouldn't even have to consciously think about. And so when we think about character, we're thinking about a kind of disposition in which we're already leaning in a certain direction. Another example at Holden would be the commitment to inclusive language, I think. You practice that enough, and that changes the way you think about yourself and the relationship between the sexes. Now, I want to now move to the moral reasoning of capitalism. The terms economics, politics, and political economy can be often confusing. The traditional definitions that we have of economics and politics really come from Aristotle. And Aristotle used economics and politics to refer to different realities. Politics referred to the life of the polis, the city. It was the public life. Whereas economics, which has the same root as the Greek word for house, had to do with life in the household. Today we still have a curriculum in school called home economics, and that's sort of using economics in Aristotle's sense. Now, for the last two centuries, since two German philosophers, Hegel and Marx, we have come to think of economics in a very different way. And the term political economy is a way of talking about this. We're no longer using economy or economics to refer to life in the individual family, the household. But we've come to think about economics as a part of our public life, political economy. Now, a kind of brief definition of economics is that discipline that is concerned with the production and distribution of scarce goods. Normally, when some good is so abundant, for example, at least until 100 years ago, air was not considered an economic good. I mean, you had all the air you wanted to breathe. But in more recent years, air has become an economic good because we can no longer count on clean air. And so we have had to devise structures to ensure that we do have clean air to breathe. You know, water used to be abundant, yeah, at least in some localities. But now water is increasingly becoming an economic resource because it's becoming scarce. So that's a kind of brief introduction to economics, politics, and political economy. Now, I've put a little short outline here on the board, and I have been so pleased with the way people have responded in discussion that I think I'm going to conduct the whole session like this and sort of clue you in on the on thinking these things out. Now let's think for a minute about number one here, the goals of an economic system. Now, if we could design a economic system, I mean, let's kind of do a little thought experiment here. Suppose that we had the possibility of creating a system from scratch. What are the kinds of things that we would want an economic system to do for us? What kind of goals would we set up? Norman?
Fairness.
Now, fairness is kind of a vague term. I mean, for example, Milton Friedman would say it's very fair. If this guy makes $5 million and this one's making $5,000, as long as they play within the rules of the game. So can you be a little more specific than fairness? See, fairness is...
Shall we say an equal opportunity along with it?
Okay, that should be equal fairness and equal opportunity, okay? All right, let's see. Okay.
I would like to see an adequate distribution of goods and services for all people.
Okay, an adequate distribution of goods and services. Now, in other words, we want a system that's going to provide us with the things we need to live. All right, so adequate.
If that we includes everyone.
Okay, adequate distribution of goods and services. So we'll put for all. Okay, we don't want to leave anybody out. Okay, anybody else? Another goal we might have.
Excuse me, with your definition, with your added words, so did that specify basic needs or essential? That's what I read into it when you mentioned that.
Adequate. You would like to put in basic here?
Well,
perhaps
that's what I got from your...
Okay. In other words, maybe we're not talking about Mercedes here. I mean, we're talking
about a basic need.
Okay.
Level.
Sort of basic. Basic goods and services for all that are necessary for a full human life.
Yeah.
Or
take that as a friendly amendment.
Okay.
Of essential goods and services, maybe, or basic.
All right. Essential. All right. Okay, now we might have some disagreement over that, but by and large, I mean, you've got to have food, you've got to have water, you've got to, although that is, does sometimes get into points of dispute. But
Are we thinking community, nationalistic, or global?
Let's think in terms of, let's think in terms of our community, or... I think that may make it more manageable. There?
I'm trying to say this, but a system that would allow work to, in most cases, has some kind of meaning with it, that there's not, just the work is not completely a superficial, alienating kind of thing.
Okay, meaningful work. In other words, work would be seen in terms of a larger purpose that might give it some kind of meaning.
The system would need to be sustaining.
Sustaining. All right. Can you be a little more specific about that?
Well, that there is not only water today, but that there will be water tomorrow.
Okay. So there's got to be a kind of conservationist element here. In other words, one has to, it's a system then that is committed not only to the immediate generation, but to those generations that will follow. Okay, sustaining. Tom?
Ought to be adequately flexible to compensate for unexpected bad things. A drought some sort of an emergency that it's not such a rigid structure that it can't compensate for a surprise.
Okay, all right. I like that. Yeah, flexible. In other words, you're not going to be tied down to a kind of rigid ideology that they can't bend when they're obvious casualties of the system. Mara?
Also a system whereby you can take care of those who are unable to care for themselves. You've been implying that, you know, everybody should have the fairness to work, but not everybody's able to do that.
Okay.
So you take care of the those unable to function.
Okay. All right, let's provisions for those unable to work. I wonder if we might not want to refine that a little bit.
I'd like also to see provision for those who are marginal, who can do something to give them a feeling of value, but can't put in what we would call a full day's work.
Full day's work, okay. In other words, we want, how about if we said it something like this, that we want a commitment to the basic unity of the human family, and therefore there's a fundamental commitment to an equality of all people that is more basic than any inequalities that the system might. What I'm trying to get at here is to say that we don't want to see just a kind of, you know, society's a kind of fireman that goes and kind of, you know, takes care of these people, but some kind of structures that enables them to participate in a way that they do have a sense of belonging and worth and acceptance. And
An economic democracy.
A kind of economic democracy.
The choices that can be made, people have an equal say in that. But money is not the amount of money you have is not the total sort of. Power in terms of making economic decisions.
Economic democracy. Yeah, I like that. That not just a political democracy, but at least some kinds of decisions ought to be made by all members of the community, regardless of their role as a producer or consumer. Mark?
Well, if you're going to add that, then you have to add some. Economic rights of minorities are also protected.
Okay. All right. So you've got to have the economic rights of minorities.
Other than that, certain essential rights which are protected irrespective of what the majority wants.
Okay.
This system has to reflect the resources of the area that you're dealing with.
Okay. Are you suggesting that it needs to be realistic with what... with what's possible,
and yes.
Okay, a kind of realism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, realism with resources. How might realism relate to human resources?
Well, you shouldn't set up a system that needs a lot of labor if it's in a sparsely settled area, because it would just impact too much.
Okay. And I was thinking along a little different line. That's a good point. And
I was thinking that, you know, that I would want a community which maximized human resources, allow people to develop their special talents and abilities, you know, as well as
you
physical resources too,
okay.
But make good use of what human resources are.
Okay, so can you put that succinctly? I'm running out of space.
That's your problem.
Hold on, only gave me one black, one white board.
I was thinking maximizing human resources.
The board is becoming a scarce resource.
That's right. resources.
There's
no other
side.
Okay. No, I've already looked. There is no other side. Okay.
There needs to be incentives.
Okay. Why do they need to be incentives?
Well,
so that people will contribute.
Okay, that's sort of the point I was leaning toward a minute ago, that I think an economic system does need to take account of original sin, as, you know, to use our theological term, and we can't depend upon a system that is going to depend upon everybody being saints. And so we've got to have some structures that are going to give incentives. Now we're going to have to be careful that the incentives don't become destructive in some kind of way. But that's kind of what I mean often by realism. But I think realism does have these other dimensions. Well, we need to
can get along with our system of taxation.
Taxation?
Equitable.
Okay, equitable taxation, that's true.
That's a detail.
That's a detail. We're dealing here with kind of broad goals. And one of the difficulties in talking about economics and ethics is we so often get ethicists have these big words. Ethicists distinguish between intrinsic values and instrumental values. Now, an intrinsic value is something that is good in and of itself. Usually music, for example, is an intrinsic value. But my stereo system or the piano is an instrumental, has instrumental value. That unless you want just a big piano in your home to look pretty as furniture, I mean, it really doesn't do much good if there's not anybody there to play it. So it's important, I think, that taxation is more of a kind of, instrumental value. It may serve as a means to accomplishing some goal. Say, taxation may be a means to accomplishing the goals of providing for those unable to work. So we need justice is certainly an intrinsic value, and we try to develop various kinds of policies. And very often, I think the problem with economists is that they get the intrinsic and instrumental values all mixed up, and so they look at the GNP as if that's the intrinsic value. Where I think an ethicist would want to look at that as more of an instrumental value, as a means to something. Well, now let's move to talk about the basic features of capitalism. We talk about capitalism all the time. What is it? Well, I don't have much choice if I'm going to write down the basic features of capitalism. You'll have to keep this in your head. What is capital? Capital.
Something you can play with.
Something you can play with.
Wealth. Okay.
It's what?
Wealth or reserve.
Okay. It's wealth, reserve.
Can you just plain say a resource?
A resource? A resource for what? For accomplishing something? Or the economist would want to say producing something? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, often going beyond where you are at the moment.
Okay.
That's why I said play with it.
Okay. Yeah, capital is a kind of elusive term. The kind of basic economic idea is that in order to produce something, you've got to have three things. You've got to have land, or you've got to have a place to do it. You've got to have labor. You've got to have somebody to work with the material. And then capital is whatever you need that's not included in land and labor. Now that's a little oversimplified, but I mean capital can be the tools of production, as Marx liked to say. It's the things that we need to produce. And so a factory and the machinery in the factory is capital, or money that one might need to buy those means of production or to pay the laborers. So you can also be capital. And the now, of course, in a socialist system, you're going to have the need for capital as well if you're going to produce. But what do we mean by capitalism as an economic system? What are the distinguishing features of capitalism?
Well, I think one is that you use the capital to produce for the individual, not the
private group individual.
Okay, the capital is privately owned. That's one of the cardinal things. Incidentally, one of the big misunderstandings of socialism is sometimes we get the idea that the socialist advocates that the government owns everything. I mean, even my underwear. But even Marx made the distinction between capital goods and personal goods. And, you know, Marx was really, when Marx talked about private property, he was referring to capital, the means of production. And, he never advocated that there shouldn't be private ownership of what we call personal goods. There?
I think one of the basic features of capitalism, though, is the belief that by putting capital into private ownership, that capital, though, in the system will be used for the good of everyone.
Everybody. Okay.
The system itself will direct it that way.
Okay. All right. This is where we're kind of getting, we start with privately owned capital. And how do we get from there to the kind of moral claims of capitalism? Now, what about another feature of capitalism, which is closely related here, is the idea of the free market. What does the free market mean?
Charge as much as you can get.
Yeah, you, as they like to say, you buy as cheap as you can and you sell as high as you can. But the idea of a free market is that whatever one produces, one ought to be able to sell at whatever price you can get for it. And you can buy at whatever price you can get something for. What's part of the appeal of the free market?
Adventure.
What?
Adventure.
Adventure? So we're kind of adventurous spirits and we go out, okay.
Profit.
Profit?
Also leaves open opportunity in the sense that if I think I can do sell something, I can make something, make a profit selling it cheaper than you, I have an automatic in.
Okay.
I'm not excluded. Or likewise, I'm not excluded from buying something if I have the resource to afford it.
Okay. So we're in a way here, we're talking about freedom in a way. I mean, you have the opportunity to make some kind of venture here. Mark?
Well, I think the nature, at least for economists, is it's supposed to be self-regulating.
Okay, right. It's how does it self-regulate?
Supply and demand.
All right. So there's a let me.
That's why I hold in mind when I'm here.
There's a. Yeah, this is a quote from Adam Smith. Now, Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, which was published in 1776, Smith was a Scottish philosopher. And but the idea of the kind of self-regulating market and the idea that these individuals acting in their own self-interest, all this kind of regulates itself, and therefore you don't have any need for a president or a king or any kind of bureaucracy to tell you what to do. This is what Smith said. Every individual is continually exerting himself to find the most advantageous employment for whatever capital he can command. It is his own advantage indeed, and not that of society, which he has in view. The idea of incentive, boy, this is for me. But the study of his own advantage naturally, or rather necessarily, leads him to prefer that employment which is most advantageous to the society. He is led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Now, see, the idea of the free market is self-regulating is that the market is a way of sending all kinds of information about the need for goods. Prices are a kind of information. If prices start going up, then boy, that lets me know people want more of this. And so I'll invest some money and make more of it. But if prices start going down, then that's information that comes and lets me know that I need to cut down on the production. And so part of the beauty of this whole thing, at least as Smith wrote about it, or as Milton Friedman today writes about it, is that it's self-regulating, it sends all the information it needs, and you don't need some king up here telling you what to do. What about... Well, we're kind of shading over here into the kind of the moral underpinnings of capitalism. What kind of moral claims do you think capitalism might want to make about itself? Okay?
Well, the basic right to private ownership.
Okay.
The private ownership is a human right.
Okay. Right of private ownership. Now, do you know where this idea of the right of private ownership comes from?
John Locke.
John Locke. Now, there's some capitalist, Michael Novak today, wants to say that it comes out of the Ten Commandments. You shall not steal. But other people argue that it comes from John Locke. John Locke was a philosopher of the late 17th century. I think he was later than 16th. 17th. Who developed the idea of certain self-evident natural rights. He talked about life, liberty, health, and property. That sounds a little bit like Thomas Jefferson, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson intentionally changed those last two because at the time he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he was afraid that the word property would be understood in terms of the British practice of primogeniture, that is, of the eldest son inheriting virtually all of the estate. And so he took life and liberty from Locke, and then put in the pursuit of happiness instead of health and property. But now, let's think about the Novak's claim that it is the Ten Commandments, or the commandment that you shall not steal, that is the basis for our modern understanding of private property. Huh?
Kind of a negative statement of a right, isn't it?
Okay.
Kind of
going through the back door.
All right. So in other words, the commandment, you shall not steal, must assume that people have a just claim to their property. Okay.
How do you get a thread through the whole Old Testament in terms of God dealing with certain chosen people and a certain land, land of milk and honey, and from that you get a broad picture of property or divine right almost to a certain area by certain people?
Okay. There are some practices in the Old Testament that that greatly qualify the notion of private property, at least as we tend to understand it. There's a recent book by a man named Bob Ganuzzi, G-N-U-S-E, published by Orbis Books. I think it's titled, You Shall Not Steal. And he basically argues that the original thrust of this commandment was not so much against taking property away from individuals, but stealing from the common storehouse. In other words, the basic thrust of this commandment, if news is right, is to ensure the right of every individual to the basic necessities of life, which during the wandering in the wilderness was basically held in common. So you probably can argue that, you know, there is a sense of a kind of defensive right of property here, but I'm not sure this commandment can bear all the weight that we sometimes want to put on it. Yeah. Mark, did you have
a couple things. The defense of private property goes back into the antique world as part of the classical philosophical tradition, and was used by Aquinas and others. But specifically on the Ten Commandments and thou shalt not steal, remember that the original law was framed for an agricultural or wandering agricultural people. Later, when they become urbanized, they have to change that law. So, for example, the Jubilee year, which is the notion of the land being recycled every 50 years, and the debts were supposed to be forgiven every, what was it, 7 years? That was all changed by the rabbis in the 2nd and 3rd centuries BCE, reinterpreted, because there was no way the society could run with that way. So there were various changes made.
Okay.
So we have to be careful about taking an ethic which was designed for a situation wandering people, and then wandering, essentially, and then rural agriculture. Apply that, and then they themselves had to change it when they went into the
system. Yeah, that's an excellent point, and that one has to distinguish certainly between biblical ethics and contemporary Christian ethics. I mean, there's a kind of ongoing process of interpretation and application and reinterpretation. I was not trying to suggest that we could simply take this over, but Jack.
Well, I was going to say, but it does seem that what we can glean from them is the concern about the well-being.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You can't say we need a jubilee today, but you certainly can
something. Yeah.
But the capitalists would say, we're talking about moral underpinnings, they would say not only is it self-regulating, but when it is allowed to self-regulate, it maximizes the well-being of society.
Of society,
And that's they think that as an article of faith, it's a highly debatable assertion. But that being, if from that position, then you are still being moral. In an urban situation, they would argue that is the moral way to make sure that most people
take one of the sort of building on that a little bit. One of the reasons I think capitalism has such a powerful moral appeal is that we can be very selfish and yet accomplish the social good at the same time. Which is exactly the argument that Smith and Friedman made. Now, there's an interesting twist to this in a recent book by George Gilder called Wealth and Poverty. Gilder is a contemporary sort of neoconservative, and this book, Wealth and Poverty, was one that President Reagan distributed to every member of his cabinet when he took office. And, not sure whether it was 80 or 84, but Anyway, in this book, Gilder kind of turns the Adam Smith quote around and says that capitalism is really based upon love. That when I realize that people need cars and I produce cars for them and sell to them, then I'm really acting out of love. And here you see, I think, a kind of transmutation of Smith, that Gilder doesn't want to be simply selfish. He wants to find a little more Christian kind of way of justifying this. And Michael Novak has even recently produced an article in which he talks about the modern corporation as being a sacramental reality. And I think Novak has lost his noodle.
I'd like to know what he said in the last board meeting.
What?
And I'd like to know what he said in the last board meeting and heard how the decision making goes.
Yeah. Right. Now, coming back to this thing of private property, throughout the early centuries of the church, at least until the kind of early modern period, private property was understood by the early church fathers and then Thomas Aquinas as a kind of concession that God makes after the fall. In other words, it was not understood as a kind of natural or inalienable right, but just as Jesus says in Mark 10, that divorce was something that God conceded because of the orneriness of people, then private property was an institution that God sort of reluctantly permitted. But the whole notion of private property was very much qualified and brought under the kind of overarching sense of stewardship in the Old and New Testament. You know, the earth is the Lord's. And so the notion of private property was always understood, might I perhaps shouldn't say always, was supposed to be understood in light of the fact that the earth is God's and that one is really a steward of that property. Now with Locke, you have a very different understanding of one's claim to property. Locke was writing at a time when America was being settled, and so you had this virgin territory, and it was very common for a group of settlers to come over, and you found a piece of land that had never been cultivated, you cut down the trees, you moved the rocks, and you built a farm. Now Locke sort of took that as his basic model and said that it is my labor that gives me claim to property. In other words, when I mix my labor with natural resources, then that gives me a claim. And there's really nothing in Locke to qualify that. And so with Locke, you begin to get an almost absolute right to property, so long as it was my labor that did that. And once I have claimed something by my labor, then I can exchange that for something else, and I have an equal claim to that I receive in return. So the essential point of this is that I think we have to be leery, be very careful about baptizing our present notions of private property with the Bible. Now, what are some other moral underpinnings of capitalism? You've got the right of private ownership, and we would probably want to say that there is an extent to which private ownership may be good. What are some of the other moral underpinnings? What would capitalism claim about itself? Okay.
I wasn't going to make this a moral underpinning, but somewhere we have to recognize the potential for maldistribution of resources, of wealth.
Okay. Okay, let's kind of hold that when we talk about maybe the moral deficiencies of capitalism.
Okay, but they would say that's a positive because you've got to have that surplus capital.
Oh, okay. Okay. In other words...
But wouldn't they, I mean, if they're dealing with it as a value, what they would say is what I said earlier, the invisible hand will see to the appropriate distribution so that it maximizes the...
Okay.
The sum of individual greed will cause society to prosper, essentially.
So in other words, you... for example, we might put this in terms of... of production. Earlier I talked a little bit about economics having to do with the production and distribution of wealth. And basically capitalism is concerned with the first part of that, production. In fact, all of the recent discussions since Reagan came in about supply-side economics. See, this is the, whereas with, since Lyndon Johnson, the emphasis has been on the distribution of that. Maybe we can kind of redistribute some of this and with a lot of the social programs. But with Reagan and the supply-side economy, see, the emphasis has gone back, Adam Smith-like, to production. That what we need to do is produce and just get the pie bigger and bigger. And then even if your proportion of the pie is smaller, it'll still be a lot more than you would have had if we simply tried to distribute a smaller pie.
But it does assume the distribution naturally will get most people.
Yeah, okay.
I was going to say that maybe what covers this in some way is simply the concept of competition.
Mm-hmm.
The competition is an absolute necessity for the working of a free marketplace. And that with competition, there are winners and there are losers.
Okay.
And that's a natural phenomenon that is good.
Okay. I think probably a lot of economists would want to say that competition, which heightens efficiency, is in fact a moral value. That this is the most efficient way to make use of what we have. As long as we allow people to compete, then I'm going to try to produce a better product at a cheaper price than you do, and in the end, this is the way it will work out.
And that is a moral value of, well, overall quality and efficiency that I think capitalists would want to say that it produces good things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How would you respond to that claim that capitalism, by its emphasis on efficiency, competition is in fact the most efficient?
This is interesting. I'm just reading for a course I'm teaching starting in the middle of August. I just read an article the other day sort of trying to get away from the competition goal and showing how competition, say, within the corporation can be very defeating for the total goal as the company as a whole. And sort of taking this look at the old capitalist American way of doing things and saying our team should win.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to, in management, look at other systems whereby Department A will cooperate with Department B to see the overall good.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of a shift away from this idea that all competition is achieving your goal.
Now that's still sort of within a corporation.
Right.
And when you look at it on a kind of a macro scale, a grand scale, you still got competition there between the corporations. Yeah.
Well, it depends on the goal of the game.
Mm-hmm.
What's the goal?
That's
maybe an overarching kind of thing about the whole goal of the capitalist system then. But is the goal, ultimately the value, is it really the community, the corporation, mm-hmm. of the people? Is that the ultimate goal of the competition? Or is it in fact simply the individual person?
All right. I think as far as an intentional goal, I mean, you read Smith and Friedman, the intentional goal is only my good. And what the what Smith and Friedman want to claim is that this will in fact also lead to the greatest good for the society.
See, that's a disclaimer right away that says to me there is an intrinsic value of the corporate. That when as soon as they say that, they have to say that in order to say that there's a greater value here, and that is the community. Because the community is screwed by this thing.
Yeah.
That's obviously not going to be good for the individual.
So in other words, you're suggesting that that the fact that somebody like Smith or Friedman argues this way, that they are kind of giving some kind of tacit commitment to a value that they don't want to claim up front. That's a very good point. Okay. Now, it may be, see, this is, when you think about our own capacity for rationalizing and self-deception and all, see, this is a way to cloak our self-interest with some kind of moral code, in a way. Reinhold Niebuhr, I think, is the genius in his description of human sin as pride. He talks about the way that we can't really see ourselves as we really are, and we have to cover over our selfishness and pride with moral justification. I mean, we're not going to admit, even as a nation, when we go to war, we're always going to be fighting for democracy or freedom or some kind of higher ideal. It's never just a matter of protecting self-interest or whatever. Barry, do you have a...
No,
well, I thought you would. Let me... The capitalists usually talk about three of the things that capitalism does very well, they claim, are freedom, efficiency, and growth. When these are the three things that capitalism usually wants to be judged by. And a part of the claim of Smith and somebody like Friedman is that the freedom that is supported by capitalism is in fact supportive of political freedom, and that the capitalist system is the best companion to a political democracy. And this is a part of his claim. Well, how would we, let's sort of start number four here, kind of the moral deficiencies of capitalism. Now, think about the kind of goals that we talked about at the first. What are some of the shortcomings of capitalism? Now, we can think of these both in empirical terms, where we have had experience with capitalism, and we can also think of it perhaps in terms of certain theoretical issues.
Well, I'm in healthcare, and just thinking about the empirical, the name of the game is to make money. So okay. Your primary motivation is not the welfare of the people, okay. But it's how to make the bottom line most productive. And you make your choices as the direction you're moving, mm-hmm. based on the economics and not the welfare of the people. Now, that would certainly defy what we had said earlier as a goal of an economic system okay. We would like to see.
Okay. In other words, that something like health care, which in our country is based so much on private enterprise kind of basis, there are certain casualties, and people do get treatment sort of in relation to their standing on the on the social ladder.
Their ability to pay.
Okay.
Okay. Disproportionate accumulation of capital by single entities.
Okay. You have, we talked about earlier about a kind of fairness in distribution, and so you do get these massive inequalities. Uh, um, Now, so how have capitalists responded to that? This doesn't bother them, Tom?
Well, I think in this case, a lot of people would say in this country there's just the pie is so big there's a lot of excess and so. Well, you kind of mentioned even that little tiny piece is still plenty big for you. Yeah. So we've met your basic needs, and since we're only really worried about society as a whole and not particularly individual, we're not really too worried about it. There's plenty to go around, and they get a little tougher spot when they get.
Yeah, right. When they get around.
One of the big deficiencies is it rewards greed.
Okay, it rewards. That's a very good point. It rewards greed. And even though capitalism claims to be very efficient, it does prove to be inefficient in certain areas. For example, if we depended solely upon capitalism, upon private enterprise, where do you think we would really be in terms of things like parks and highways? All the roads would be toll roads. You'd have somebody that decides to build a road, and then he's going to...
You have no United States National Forest.
Probably. Yeah, there probably wouldn't be any National Forest.
We'd probably be sitting here.
A real problem now is expensive health care.
Okay.
Isn't that a good example?
Yeah, that's a good example. But whether, for example, for those who can pay, we spend a lot of our health facilities on some kind of operations that are not essential to health but may make somebody look better or something, and perhaps that money might be better spent somewhere else. I mean, that's a question. Yeah.
There's several things I would say. First of all, that in addition to the problems of the being based on greed and what that does in terms of leaving people out around healthcare, it also creates a moral context in which the moral question then is one of rights. It's always the individual rights conflicting with each other instead of a whole moral atmosphere in the country which has a real concern for the common unity that you were talking about before. So that the system itself, even apart from the individual failures economically, creates a whole moral atmosphere that I think is pretty bankrupt.
Okay.
The other thing I was going to say in response to the question about how capitalism would respond to the massive inequalities, I think there are two things. First of all, a lot of them would say that the inequalities are caused because we haven't let the capitalist system really operate. That it's really because we tried to make it too regulated and even approach some kind of socialist parts of it that's a problem. Or that the inequalities are necessary, sort of what you were saying, but even a step beyond, that they're really necessary to create the kinds of incentives that eventually still give the basic needs to everyone.
Yeah.
It's evolution.
What?
The basic notion of evolution.
Of evolution,
that, you know, that's somewhere out of the strong.
Well, yeah. Well, this was very prominent in the late 19th century with your social Darwinism, which went hand in hand.
Well, there's an assumption that there is competition, and that the balance can tilt by the competitive forces. And one of the problems is when competition is removed, either by monopoly or by other.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The underlying assumption, in my opinion, of capitalism is that we have unlimited resources and therefore unlimited potential for growth. Yeah. That is not true in the physical world as we know it today. Yeah. So it is almost diametrically opposed to what I think is going to have to come into being in the world, and that is a global look and limits to growth.
Mm-hmm. The point you make, I think, is raises real questions about Locke's notion of property. Because, I mean, at the time Locke is writing, it does make sense to say that I should have some claim to this property because I cleared it and I have farmed it. But now that the land is, there is very little of that kind of frontier left, then, perhaps we need certainly a new look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Jack and then Mark. Okay.
I've got to pass.
Okay. Back on the accumulation of wealth, I thought we missed one of the basics of capitalism, and that is that I have a right to accumulate excessive wealth because I am taking a risk of losing all
yeah.
of my wealth.
Okay. Yeah. The another sort of moral claim of capitalism that I think has to be, you know, given some credit, is the idea that capitalism does encourage creativity and risk-taking that would not otherwise occur. And that the incentive for doing that is the fact that I get to keep what I make. Okay?
It seems also to allow or even encourage the abuse of resources, human resources and labor that is left yeah. in the lurch so that you can move to where
okay.
labor is cheaper, land,
okay.
water,
yeah.
air.
Okay.
If you're going to make a profit,
to
you abuse.
Okay.
Because we talked about something earlier that I think we might have missed too, and that's this competition. And it's the lack of competition, I believe, that leads to that abuse that she's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's what every self-interested capitalist is looking for. He's looking for an edge, which is lack of competition, which he can abuse.
Yeah.
If you have open competition, that's a check, a balance that we have often lost
right.
in our system.
That was a recent paper given at a meeting I went to dealing with exactly with this issue. Our time is just about up. One more question or whatever. Norm?
I was going to comment that I think that capitalism as a philosophy in the last several hundred years of Western culture has been primarily responsible for the world of today in terms of poverty around the world.
Well, at the same time, it has also, you know, produced for us a lot of wealth.
Oh, no question. But we're wealthy,
yeah.
and you
okay.
see,
okay.
we're talking about so much interest
okay.
in third world nations, and we create problems.
Yeah. The thing about economics is that, you know, unless one finds oneself squarely on the left or squarely on the right, it seems to me that most of the kind of questions we raise are not usually questions between a kind of unalloyed good and an unmitigated curse. It's kind of like these are all relative kinds of things, and you know, somehow we have got to break out of our kind of ideological blinders. It has to be all this way or all this way, and look for new kinds of structures that can avoid both the casualties that capitalism seems to have produced, as well as the abuses of some of the experiments with communism.
Isn't that sort of part of the moral underpinnings? I mean, I think that there are people who are sort of really pure ideological capitalists who
mm-hmm.
really believe that the system, if left by itself, would operate
mm-hmm.
purely. But then most people recognize the problems, but the moral underpinning then becomes not that this is a perfect system, but because this is the
best
system.
Yeah.
There is no
yeah.
other system.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so you close off any debate because
yeah.
there's nothing else that's at all better.
Yeah. Well, see, another problem related to that I have when I talk to economists is that they want to claim economics is a science, and therefore you don't tinker with it with moral questions. But I think it's too important to leave to the economists, and it's probably too important to leave to the ethicists too. So, all right, well.